Welcome to Torah Yomecha, Nachyomi with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Rena Foreman, and today we will be studying Yechezkel Perek Vav, Chapter 6. In the last couple of prakim, we have seen God make good on his concession to Yechezkel to have him act merely as a tzofeh, someone who warns the people, rather than an ish mochiach, someone who expects to effect change. As we pointed out, God allows Yechezkel to move away from messaging through words and transitions him toward an action-oriented role. And at the end of Perek Gimel, God tells Yechezkel that he has kind of lost his chance for speech, v'ne'alamta. From now on, Yechezkel is to demonstrate the message to the people using actions. But if we pay attention, we will notice that these are not just actions. These actions all involve Yechezkel's body. In Perek Daled, he lays on the sides of his body while looking at a brick representation of Yerushalayim, which he has created with his own hands. He only lets food that is reminiscent of a siege pass through his mouth. Finally, in Perek Hay, he shaves off with the aid of a tar all the hair on his body. Cut it off and divide it into three piles, God instructs him. What's next for our Navi Namaim? Well, as we start to read Perek Vav, we see that God tells him, Hinaveh, give forth your prophecy. Hinaveh implies a command to give a verbal prophecy, which is strange, right? Because we just saw that God told Yechezkel that he is to remain silent for a long time. He's to remain silent, according to the Pesukim in Perek Gimel, until the Palit, the refugee, comes and reports that the city has been destroyed. And that won't be happening for another 6 years or so. So why is God telling him to prophesy verbally now? In order to understand, let's read the Pesukim. In Pasuk Bet, we hear something a bit strange. Sim panecha el harei Yisrael vihina be'alehem. God tells Yechezkel, turn your face toward the mountains of Israel and give forth your prophecy. While the word hinabeh does tell us that Yechezkel is asked to give a verbal message, we learn now that the audience isn't the people of Israel, at least not directly. It's actually the mountains of Israel. It's almost like, since he isn't supposed to speak to the people, God is instructing the Navi to warn the people vicariously, indirectly, by addressing inanimate objects, the mountains. This strategy of talking indirectly to inanimate objects makes it easier on Yechezkel and more palatable to the people who, we know, don't really want to listen, as God told Yechezkel earlier, Im yishma'u ve'im yachtalu. They're not likely to listen. But it appears there is yet another strategy, even more obscure and indirect, that the text in Yechezkel employs to help him make his point. That strategy is to quote from a particular earlier text in Torah, a text which presumably the people are pretty familiar with. We'll notice in reading Prakim Vav in Zion, as well as taking a closer look at Perek Hay, that the text at various points is actually lifting or quoting whole phrases from Vayikra Chafav. Yes, our prakim are replete with parallels to sections in Vayikra, known as the Tochacha. Let me give you some examples. The words used to describe idolatry, Gilulim and Chamanim, pretty unusual words, right? Well, they appear here in Yechezkel, but also back in the Tochacha of Vayikra, to describe the idols worshipped by the people. Here's another example. In both scenarios, the sins of the people are referred to as Toivot, a word that connotes perverse behavior. A third example, the idea of scattering, referred to as Ezra and Afitz, are buzzwords in both texts. And a fourth, hunger in both texts is referred to with the same striking metaphor, the breaking of a rod of bread, v'shavarti matel lechem. We can keep going. Cherev arig achareihem, a sword will go after them, is another striking phrase that appears in both texts. But why? Why does the text in Yechezkel seem to intentionally use so many unmistakable references to those Tochacha portions of Torah? To answer this, let's think about what we know of the nation during Yechezkel's time. Well, when we think of the people of Israel as described in Yechezkel, what's the word that comes to mind? The word Meri is probably the first word that comes to mind. The phrase Beit Meri is used repeatedly to describe the people. In fact, God himself tells Yechezkel that the people are a Beit Meri, and therefore not worth rebuking. They won't accept your rebuke, God tells Yechezkel. Lo yavu lishmoa elecha. How easy is it for anyone, let alone a rebellious nation, to accept rebuke? Not very. So Yechezkel is in a bit of a conundrum. On the one hand, as we saw at the end of Perek Gimel, God told Yechezkel not to rebuke the people. Lo tehi lahem leish mochiach. Don't rebuke them. Yet, He is still to act as a tzofeh, someone who is a scout who wards the people. Hinena taticha tzofeh. So what's a Navi to do? Somehow, Yechezkel's solution to this challenge seems to be the use of tochacha references. What does he hope to convey? Let's try to get into Yechezkel's head, so to say. Maybe Yechezkel's intuition tells him that rebuking a Beit Meri head-on is only going to backfire. So, knowing that as a Beit Meri, it would be very difficult for the people to accept rebuke, Yechezkel uses references to the tochacha. It might be his way of hinting to the people just how severe their sins are. Without quite spelling it out, he is telling them in as indirect a way as he can that their sins are egregious enough to deserve punishments. Punishments as jarring as those described in the tochacha. By addressing his speech to the inanimate objects in words that echo the harshest of rebuke passages from the Torah, Yechezkel has figured out a way of making his message and warning also a message of indirect rebuke. A message that at the same time is palatable. I do want to call your attention to one last parallel to the tochacha that I think sheds light on some very difficult to understand parts of the Sefer we're learning. This particular parallel comes from the beginning of the tochacha in Vayikra, which actually starts off with a blessing. It tells us, if you keep my commands, life will be really good for you. Cherev lo tavor ba'artzecha, the sword won't even pass through your land. So that was the blessing back in Vayikra. A passing sword. But as we pointed out when we learned Parakeh, we have the same confluence of these two verbs at the beginning of Parakeh and at the end. Let's look at the beginning. Kach lecha cherev chada, tara galavim tikachen alech, v'havarta arosh chaval zekanecha. You see the cherev and tavor once again. I think this cherev and tavor connection to the tochacha might help us understand something about that strange command Yechezkel was instructed to carry out, that moment he was supposed to take a sharp cherev and pass it over tavor, his skin. You see, if you were just reading that verse in Yechezkel in isolation without thinking about the parallels to the tochacha, it just sounds like Yechezkel is being asked to take a little shave. No big deal, or maybe a big shave. No great spiritual implications to a shave, right? But now that we are clued into these parallels with the tochacha, recall that Yechezkel's razor is parallel to a sword passing over land. That's a bigger deal, isn't it? Let's think for a moment about this connection. The razor passing over Yechezkel's skin is somehow comparable to a sword passing over land. What should we make of that? Well, a sword passing through land feels like it would destroy anything living on the land that is in its way. And let's take a moment to think about hair in that context. When you think of your hair sprouting from your skin, do you consider that hair a living part of you? Are you still entirely yourself without your hair? Or is your hair part of the composite picture that makes you feel like you? I can only tell you that my 3-year-old grandson, Kobe, used to get very worried when his blonde curly hair was wet after taking a bath or brush back. His young words are very telling. When his hair dried or was put back, he would say, "Now Kobe is back. Kobe is back in town." His hair was part of his identity. Hair is in some way alive, and it is a part of us. Moreover, it seems that having one's hair removed can also be associated with shame. One example of this is in Sefer Shmuel in Perkut Aleph, when King Hanun removes part of the beards of the people of Yavesh Gilad. These people were so embarrassed that the king, David, told them to stay put until their beards, their hair, grew back. Perhaps in the Holocaust, too, the reason the Nazis shaved the hair of the inmates wasn't to sanitize them, as they claimed, but to take away part of their identity, making them just a number. Hair is more part of us than we think. In that context, how do we view the removal of Yechezkel's hair? What might his hair represent? The hair which grows on the skin is akin to that which lives upon the land, that which helps give the land its identity. The Psukim tell us that these three sections of hair represent the three sections of people on the land. Three ways in which the demise of the city people will take place. So if hair represents people, the next question is, what does Yechezkel's body represent? Logic would tell us that Yechezkel's hair represents the people. Logic would indicate that if Yechezkel's hair represents the people, his hair would have to represent the land. Just as hair is rooted in a body, so are the people rooted in the land. The sword cutting the hair from Yechezkel's body symbolizes the people being removed from the land and sent into exile. Stand back and think about it. What really is a nation? It is a land with people living on it. The identity of a nation consists of the people as well as their land. But the people are rooted in the land. Sure, you can remove them through exile. But if you do, you take away something of their life. Once hair is removed from the body, it is no longer alive. The people outside of their land are not quite as alive either. And being thrown out of the land, the people have lost part of their identity. The nation is no longer a nation. It is this nation, the inanimate land part of the nation, analogous to Yechezkel's body, that Yechezkel addresses himself, albeit indirectly, in Perek Vav. Our Perek Vav names the multiple parts of the land where idol worship took place. There are many descriptions of the multiple parts of the land, the types of mountains which the people used to serve their idols. Yechezkel is addressing the mountains, the body of the nation, the body from which the people are in the process of being uprooted from. Hare Yisrael. Ko'amar Hashem, laharim v'lekva'ot v'la'afikim v'la'gayayot. He tells them, on these mountains, the corpses of the dying people will be piled. These very mountains were the Avodah Zarah, described with the unusual term Gilulim and Chamanim, were originally served. V'neshamu mizbechotechem v'nishperu chamanechem. It's kind of fitting that the corpses and bones of the idolaters will be scattered all around the altars, the places on the land where they served the idols. The act of the hair, so to speak, in other words, the people serving other gods on these mountains, the body of the nation, is what caused the separation of the nation from its source. And that separation is not easy to repair. Much as many of us may have wished one time or another after a bad haircut, the reality remains that once hair is cut off, it can't be reattached. But here's the interesting thing. That verse from the Tochacha, Cherev lo tavor ba'arzachem, which finds its echo in Yechezkel, it also helps explain how the nation came to the situation it finds itself in the times of Yechezkel. It helps explain why there was a plethora of idols at this time. It helps explain the catalyst for all this. Remember at the beginning of Bechukotai, Becherev lo tavor ba'arzachem tells us about a time when there will be no threat of war, not even the threat of a sword passing over the land. I'd like to take a moment to recap the history of our time period, because there was a moment in time when that blessing from Vayikra, the sword won't pass through the land, seemed on the cusp of being realized. Here's what happened. King Menasheh, the son of Chizkiyahu, was one of the worst kings that existed, so much so that Chizkiyahu was loath to give birth to a son, as he saw the damage he caused, especially in the area of Avodah Zarah, of idol worship. Menasheh's descendant, Yoshiyahu, the king who recently preceded Yehoyachin, tried valiantly to correct the problem and eradicate the Avodah Zarah. He got pretty far and was quite happy with his initial accomplishments. But Yoshiyahu underestimated how much progress had truly been made. He felt things were in such a good state that God was looking at his generation as a people who were keeping the commands fully, as the beginning of Parsha Bechukotai outlines. Unfortunately, Yoshiyahu misread the situation. He ended up dying prematurely and missing the opportunity to fully finish the job of stamping out the idol worship started by his ancestor Menasheh. Interestingly, according to Chazal, his fatal mistake was relying on Becherev lo tavor ba'arzacha. He relied on the fact that the people's actions were in such great shape that they could rely on God not letting a sword pass through their land. Chazal explained that because he relied on this promise that a sword won't pass through the land of Israel, Yoshiyahu didn't let Paro Necho pass through his land. As a result, Paro went to war against him, and Yoshiyahu ultimately died in battle, not having the chance to fully eradicate the Avodah Zarah, leaving open the opportunity for the people to climb right back on the Avodah Zarah bandwagon. The analogy that comes to my mind is getting started on an organization project. Let's call it cleaning out your closet. You make lots of piles. You make really good progress, but only you can tell what is going on. To someone else, it looks like a huge mess. And sadly, after all your work, it will become just that, a huge mess, if you don't take the time to complete the job. In fact, your piles that only you know the meaning of may contribute to an even bigger mess than before. Like our closet, from looking at the psukim, it seems that not only was Yoshiyahu's work basically undone, but the idol worship was as rampant as before, if not worse, possibly an even bigger mess. The Avodah Zarah syndrome, still left over from the days of Yoshiyahu, becomes the theme of Perek Vav. The idols were served on the mountaintops, the audience of Yechezkel's Nevuah. Perhaps the message here is that once the galut starts, once the hairs are separated from their source, the hair needs time to grow back. Returning to the land will happen, but it won't happen immediately. Another round of hair needs to grow. The shame and embarrassment need a chance to heal. Another generation, not this one, entrenched in the sin of idol worship, will re-inhabit the land. It's going to be a process for the hair to grow back, for the people, the hair, to reconnect to the land, their body. Thank you for studying together, Le'ilui Nishmat, Riva Schwab, Rivka Bat Alexander.